family visits may be easier and more money may be flowing between the U.S. and Cuba. So what's next? Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, where we discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making headlines. NPR Morning Edition host David Green joins us after spending a week in Cuba talking with government officials and entrepreneurs, shopkeepers, and fishermen. Did the state fudge data over child abuse deaths? A Miami-Dade grand jury accuses the state child welfare agency of undercounting child abuse and neglect deaths. Meantime, Governor Scott signs into law an overhaul of the Department of Children and Families. And the cost to taxpayers of the rush to open up charter schools, only to have them close down quickly. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup, next here on WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
From NPR, I'm Greg Allen. Thanks for listening.
This week, we start in Cuba. Over the past few years, the Obama administration has been loosening restrictions on travel and money going to Cuba. And the Castro regime has been loosening a few economic restrictions on Cubans there. Now, some, Greg, may say the U.S. is motivated by politics and the Castro changes are motivated by the economy there.
Well, Tom, tensions between the U.S. and Cuba haven't changed much in recent years. American Alan Gross has spent the past 5 years in a Cuban prison, accused of spying on Cuba for America. Gross was arrested while working through the U.S. Agency for International Development on helping Cuban Jewish groups get internet access. Meantime, Three of the Cuban five remain in American prisons. The quintet was convicted in 2001 for spying on America. One was also charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Two have been released after serving most of their sentences.
Yeah, but the three do, as you mentioned, still remain in American prisons. And before we talk about the diplomacy or the dollars, NPR Morning Edition host David Green spent last week in Cuba hearing from shopkeepers, entrepreneurs, fishermen, and teenagers about the past and the future.
This used to be a pot of crickets. It was the saddest place on earth.
Have you been to Haiti? That's what Cuba used to be like. A few people were rich and everyone else was starving.
What's going on over there?
They're building a zona franca, like a free zone.
Everybody talking about it?
Sí. Ha cambiado mucho.
He says it's changed a lot here.
I just decided to do this. I always liked to have my own money.
And then the government said that people are going to be able to have cuenta propia because there was a high unemployment rate and that everyone could do, anyone who wanted to could do it.
Some tourists says that this country is growing up now and it's going to get better and better. I've been waiting and waiting. I don't know, I have many friends out of Cuba, like in the United States, England, other countries. They say over there you have to work very hard, but you can see the results. So I want to see the results here.
Voices about the past, the present, and the future across the generations in Cuba. Just a few of the voices that NPR's David Green shared with us from his week in Cuba. David joins us now here on the Florida Roundup. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett also with us. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. David, impressions that you took away from this week-long visit that you spent in Cuba?
You know, I think one of the impressions is, you know, that last voice right there. There is an impatience. There is a feeling that, you know, as he said, that, you know, they're not feeling the results of these economic reforms that Raul Castro has talked about. But not an overwhelming amount of impatience. I mean, there still really is among some people on that island a real belief in socialism and a socialist framework, even when you talk about big dollars. I mean, you had a voice there from a fisherman we spoke to in the resort island of Varadero on the northern coast, and there was this, you know, bring in the hotels, bring in the money, bring in the tourists. And I would challenge people and say, well, you know, isn't that going to lead to class divisions? Isn't that going to be troubling for society if you have people who are able to work in these hotels and get the big tips? And one person after another would say, no, that money's going to come into the government. The government's going to feed it into social services, and it's going to reach all of us. So it's just an interesting dynamic right now. I just wonder when the point is going to come that, that this impatience sort of really boils over, and you know, that there is some sort of pressure on the Castro regime, you know, if pressure matters to them. Again, this is a regime that, that doesn't necessarily listen to people. But we just try to get beneath some of these stories and not just, you know, sort of fall into the narrative of, oh, Cuba's changing. It's a narrative that we've heard for so many years now. Yeah. We really wanted to get into people's lives and try and understand, you know, the emotions right now and whether those changes have meant anything.
And Tim Padgett with WLRN, those changes can be seen certainly in how the Cuban-American community here in South Florida has evolved its approach to Cuba. It's become more nuanced through the years, and perhaps nuanced is the voices that David brought back.
Oh, definitely. We just had a new poll come out from Florida International University. These have been coming out for the past 11 years. And we saw that now a majority of Cubans in Miami now support getting rid of the trade embargo against Cuba. 51-52%, I think, say that. And that's you know, when you think about a decade ago, that 87% of Cubans in Miami were saying, no, keep the embargo. So we have seen a real sea change, and a particularly a growth of moderate Cubans in the community here.
But, you know, at the same time, as you know, Tim, we've seen this trend happen, and we talk about it in terms of internal politics here in the state. But we saw what happened with Charlie Crist recently, who's one of the Democrats who's running for governor, and he was saying that he's thinking about maybe we should lift the embargo, which, you know, goes along with that poll. Right. But then he also said, oh, but I think also I might travel to Cuba soon. Mm-hmm. And he said that, and there started to be an upsurge of somewhat resentment. Even people who want to lift the embargo thought, well, what's he saying about going to travel there? And so they backed off that fairly quickly.
One of the realities here is that you can take all the polls you want, and we can see all the growth among moderate Cubans that we want. But the reality is, moderate Cuban Americans still aren't voting. And I think one of the most telling aspects of that recent poll was that Cubans who are registered to vote in Miami, a majority of them still support the embargo.
David, in your travels throughout Cuba, if you didn't ask about the embargo, how often was an opinion offered about this two-generation-old embargo?
Well, you know, if we talk to people from the government, it was the first thing out of their mouths. if you talk to people not in the government, it really didn't, you know, it wasn't the first topic. And you know, what interests me, if we look at some of the economic changes that Raul Castro is talking about, I mean, we heard one of the voices there about Mariel Port, which, you know, I mean, a place that has such interesting resonance through Cuban history. I mean, more than 100,000 people leaving from there to come to the shores here. And now, you know, they're trying to build this deep water port. But everyone we spoke with, including an economist who works very closely with the government, said that this thing is going to be a major success if the embargo ends, if that American market opens up. Same goes for the tourism. You know, they're building hotels, but that, you know, it's for those hotels to succeed, for the tourism economy to really come alive, it's going to rely on those few million American tourists who they expect to come, and that's not going to happen. So there really is this sense of, you know, no one really is talking about it overtly, but all the changes that are taking place in terms of the economy are with this expectation that the embargo might not be there.
One of the government voices you spoke to, Josefina Vidal, is director of U.S. relations for the Cuban Foreign Ministry, and she said the changes in U.S. policy toward Cuba, she called them limited and slow. I think that most Americans would also agree with that. Mm-hmm. You also asked her about Hillary Clinton's recent comments about what the former First Lady, former U.S. Senator, former presidential candidate, possibly future presidential candidate, talked about advocating for the end of the embargo. Vidal's reaction.
If you think this is a pretext, lift it. Eliminate the embargo so that you can put us to test. Try us, okay? So lift it.
Tim, in the international diplomacy world, this poker game that's gone on between the United States and Cuba, between Washington, D.C. and Havana for the better part of 50-plus years now, this is calling the bluff. This is at least the threat to call the bluff, the call to call the bluff.
Well, I'm one of those journalists who still thinks that if we were to call their bluff, they would not be happy. To lift it. I really do think that the Cuban government has been able to use the embargo for the past half century as a scapegoat, not only for their own economic blunders, but as a reason to crack down in the human rights context.
Well, I guess we might get a chance to see. I don't know about, you know, the idea of lifting the embargo is, since it would take an act of Congress, you'd have to undo the Helms-Burton law. You know, we all know what Congress is like right now. Even if you get past the election year, I don't know how that would ever come to pass, unless for some reason Republicans and Democrats agreed on that, and I don't see that happening.
David, the voices, again, that you spoke to, the sense that they had about life after an embargo, do they have an expectation? Do they have an anticipation of what it could be like?
I think they do. I mean, especially we spent, 36 hours or so traveling from the coast and spending time with people who work in hotels and restaurants in Varadero. And, you know, they are making tips of perhaps sometimes $15 a night, which, you know, doesn't sound like all that much for bartenders in the United States. But I mean, that's a month's wage, or at least a half a month's wage in Cuba. So it's huge. And there's the feeling that American tourists, they tip if they come, you know, that's going to fall into the pockets of Cubans, and it'll help a lot. So it's not that people bring it up in the sense of the embargo's there, we want it to end or not, but everything they're talking about, it's sort of with this expectation that you know, 90 miles away, there's going to be a change in policy. That's going to change a lot in Cuba.
Let us know what your thoughts are on the Cuban embargo. Do you still have family in Cuba living under this embargo for 50-some years? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN.
I thought one of the most insightful reports that David and his team did had to do with entrepreneurs down in Cuba. And this is really where we're seeing a real sea change in the way we're approaching how to engage Cuba. I think there's a consensus now that entrepreneurs can play as much a role in undermining the communist dictatorship in Cuba as dissidents have. And so we're looking for ways now to pump up the entrepreneurial activity there. And was really telling in one of your reports when you had this woman who was having a lot of success selling apparel. Imported apparel, and then all of a sudden, the Cuban government said, "No more of this, because you're really becoming too much an economic threat, and I think also a political threat to the government."
And I never really got an answer, Tim, as to why the government made that decision. I mean, this young woman was bringing in imported clothing. She had figured out a way to make a good bit of money. We went to her market. I mean, she was there with, customers coming in. I mean, it felt like success. I mean, this young woman was really running a great business. And then the government suddenly announced in a newspaper that as of December 31st, you know, no more imported clothing could come in and be resold. I sat down with this economist from the Cuban government. I asked him three times, I mean, what is the argument to shut that down? And I never got a really clear answer. You're suggesting some of it is that
and
she is
and
a
you
political threat.
You probably won't get a clear answer, because I think what that one instance is really proof that the growing number of entrepreneurs and their growing economic clout really is a threat to the government. And in that context, I think that the reformers here in the United States are right, that they are a channel of undermining the government.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Let's join the conversation with Dave, joining us from Miami. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. Speaking as a person whose parents are Cuban and who arrived here long before Castro, and who was born here, I've never been to Cuba, but I live in Little Havana, and, let me put it to you this way. First of all, tomorrow, the embargo against Cuba could end tomorrow. The Castro brothers will have none of it. They're simply going to turn around and say, "Oh, you see, it's those Americans trying to infiltrate us and trying to undermine our government. They won't have us. They won't have it. It's their reason to be." Such overtures had been made before, and the Cuban government has shown a willingness to reject it. Second of all, I have seen a lot of this happening. Cubans that come over here, make money, go back to Cuba, and vacation there. I really don't believe that they are political refugees anymore. I think they're economic refugees more than anything else. Considering Cuba and Haiti, I think Haiti has as big, if not bigger, problems than Cuba. I would say give equal protection to Haitian refugees or get rid of the Cuban Adjustment Act.
Mike, we appreciate the comments. Dave from Miami there, obviously still in support of the embargo. And Tim, he makes a kind of that argument that we hear a lot in terms of immigration policy and the carve-out that there has been for so many years in regards to Cubans.
Right, and we heard this morning on an NPR, Marco Rubio making that same complaint that, look, you know, what's the point of all this is, you know, if we've just got Cubans going back and forth, making a lot of money here and then taking it back to Cuba, it's as he said, it's time to revisit that whole...
But you know, it's interesting, Tom, that they've always used that argument, people like Marco Rubio, Mario Diaz-Balart, Ileana Ross-Layton are members of Congress, because they'd like to see travel restrictions actually put back in place.
Right.
They think that travel has become too easy for Cuban Americans, you know, who now can travel over pretty much whenever they want to if they have family members there. And it used to be once every 3 years. They'd like to restore those because they say this free flow of travel back and forth has just leads to people having almost like a gray market of activities where they will feed these entrepreneurs over there with child's apparel or with machinery or things that they bring on the plane from Miami. We're seeing a regular traffic of goods in that, and that kind of that might undermine the embargo in some way. And so it's a small but significant chink in that 50-year-old embargo.
Arch is joining the conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Fort Lauderdale. Arch, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I was curious with the series of the reports why the reporter really didn't delve at all into some of the international companies that are doing blockbuster business in Cuba and the big tourism trade with Canada and Spain, and it seems that as a destination there are almost as many Canadians going to Cuba as they do to South Florida, and not to mention anything about the listed public companies, both the some that are even listed through OTC on the U.S. stock exchange, but
sure.
Our public companies, Sherritt International is one from Toronto, and other big companies.
Arch, I think we've got it. You make an interesting question here, and David Green, you did talk about some of the interest, the economic interest in Cuba from certainly outside the United States. And we have to remember, this is just an American embargo. This is not a global embargo.
Right,
so
sure.
There's plenty of other countries and plenty of other foreign domiciled companies that are investing in many different ways in Cuba.
And Brazil is at the top of the list right now. I mean, Odebrecht, I mean, a major Brazilian firm, the government of Brazil, they're investing, you know, nearly $1 billion into Mariel Port. And you know, this is at a moment when there's a lot of uncertainty about how committed the Castro government is to making this really a free trade zone at that port. There are restrictions in place. Foreign companies who come in and use that port can't hire Cuban workers directly. They have to go through government contracting. The taxes potentially sound like they're going to be very high, but Brazil has really committed. And we brought in my colleague, NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro, who's based in Brazil. And we had, you know, to me, a really interesting conversation I learned a lot from. I mean, she was saying that it's an opportunity right now for a country like Brazil to get a foothold in a port right near the United States. But there's also a political reason, because a lot of Latin American countries, there's a resonance when they partner with Cuba.
And we've seen that with Venezuela. We've seen, you know, the vacuum that was left after the collapse of the Soviet Union that a number of Latin American countries have gone into and really fulfilled.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and right now the Cuban government is very scared about what's going on in Venezuela, because that's been their economic lifeline in this past decade, just the way the Soviet Union was in the 20th century. And countries like Brazil, I think there's a duality there. On the one hand, they do want an economic and investment foothold in this corridor up here, especially with things like the expansion of the Panama Canal going on. On the other hand, there is, I think, as Lourdes also pointed out, there is a sort of romanticism on the part of especially center-left or leftist governments like Brazil's. And I think what you're seeing in this investment, it's almost that it's sort of a mix of aid and investment that's going on, because they do have that admiration for Cuba.
Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Stay close. Plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Did the Florida Department of Children and Families tinker with data on child deaths from abuse and neglect? That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
I'm Greg Allen from NPR. This week, a Miami-Dade grand jury both praised and condemned Florida's Department of Children and Families. The grand jury reviewed recommendations made 3 years ago after 10-year-old Nubia Bajorona's body was found decomposing in her stepfather's pickup truck. Child welfare authorities have had contact with Nubia for more than a decade.
Yeah, it was really a tragic case, an awful case for all those involved, Greg. And while the grand jury this week found DCF has implemented improvements since 2011, jurors also accused the agency of, quote, intentionally and deliberately undercounting child deaths from abuse and neglect. A Miami Herald investigation, Innocence Lost, identified 477 kids who had had contact with the agency dying from abuse and neglect verified deaths since 2008. It was in 2010 when the agency changed its definition of what would be a verified death by neglect to require intent. The effect excluded some deaths by drowning and unsafe sleeping. Now, Mike Carroll is the interim head of the Department of Children and Families. We spoke to him earlier via Skype.
Listen, I value what the grand jury said. I think the grand jury rightfully saw some of the improvements the department has made since the Barahona case. I understand their concern with the change in definition. I don't think the intent was to undercount anything. I think the intent was to make it more consistent across regions on how we do this. And I think the definition around a verified report, or even the issue, quite frankly, around counting child deaths, is one that we struggle with not only in this state but nationally. We are going to revisit it, and we will hopefully come up with a standard that's more in line with a national standard.
Help us out understand that those of us who are not seeped in child welfare policy and policy making, seems like there's a strong dose of common sense about an infant or a toddler dying from natural causes, dying from accidental causes, and dying from neglect or abuse.
Well, I think you're right about that, but I think that when folks look at it, and the ones we struggle with, you said it was unsafe sleep and child drownings. It's not against the law for a mom to bring their baby to bed with them or to be holding them. And so we have cases where you have a mom who has several small children. She just had a baby. The kids most at risk are age 2 to 4. So you have a very young child. You're tired. You fall asleep with that child on the couch, and that child ends up suffocating. Is that an act of neglect or an act of abuse? You know, it's very easy to stand back and say, child drowning can happen to anybody. I had my child adopt my child through the child welfare system. He was 5 feet from me. We taught him to swim as an infant. He's 3 years old, running toward me on a pool deck. He falls, goes butt first onto the deck. I can hear the diaper pop to this day, and goes into the water head first. I had no problem with him in the water because I thought he could swim. And yet, because of the nature of the way he went in, he did nothing. He floated to the bottom of the pool, spread eagle, with his hands and legs wide open, his eyes open, his mouth open. Now, I happened to be just feet from him, and I got to him right as he hit the bottom of the pool. But it was silent, and it was quick. And if I had my back turned even for an instant and didn't hear it there, but for the grace of God, go, I am my child. This is a tragedy, particularly child drownings and unsafe sleep, too, that we've got to get our arms around as a state.
What's the impact of the definition on the death data that the department reports?
If you looked out on the website that we recently provided, it does look like right after 2010, we had a slight decline in the number of cases that were verified, and that tracked with the decline we had in the overall number of reports that we received to the hotline. So it did look like it had some impact. I can tell you going forward, it's going to be less of an impact because two things that have happened that I think are going to begin to change the dialogue around this. The first thing is that we did release our first version of the Child Fatality Prevention website the other day. It only has data in it from January 1st to present, but it's our intent to have data that goes back 6 years up in live by September 1st, and we will have data in it that goes back 10 years live by the end of the year.
Will that data include the 2010 definition of intent for a death to be considered neglect?
It will include all child deaths, regardless of whether they were verified or not. So what it's going to be a total transparency in that we're releasing information on all child deaths, regardless of whether it was verified or not.
That was Department of Children and Families Interim Secretary Mike Carroll.
And we're joined with David Green from NPR and Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald, who led the investigation Innocence Lost. Carol, you co-wrote that investigation, finding 477 deaths, verified deaths by child abuse or neglect, kids who had had contact with the agency since January 2008. Mike Carroll, the interim head, talked about a lack of uniformity in that definition of a neglect or abuse death. Your thoughts?
Well, it's absolutely true that there was very little consistency across districts in Florida as to whether a death would be verified as resulting from abuse or neglect. The inconsistency largely stemmed from what the grand jury called, and what our investigation certainly supported, was a deliberate effort to induce those numbers to decline. In Broward County, where the Department of Children and Families does not investigate child deaths, BSO does, the Broward Sheriff's Office, the rate of child death with families who had a DCF history was the highest in the state. And that is because folks not affiliated with the agency, folks who had a little independence, were reviewing those cases and closing them.
Mike Carroll talks about aiming for uniformity across the regions of the Department of Children and Families, uniformity even in how other state agencies and other states define neglect and abuse. And my question to him about common sense, I'll put it to you as well. You know, for those of us that aren't involved in the line-by-line policy definitions of child abuse and neglect deaths, is it missing? Is common sense missing in this?
I think at times you look at these cases and it seems to me that common sense is missing. One of the anecdotes that was repeated in the grand jury report that the Herald had reported was an incident during the Memorial Day weekend in 2011. A young mother was sitting poolside at a community pool. I should say not poolside. She was some distance away. Mm-hmm. Her very young child was in the pool. She was on a chaise lounge texting her friends, and the child drowned. That is, to my reckoning, a neglect death. You do not allow yourself to not have a very young child within eyesight for a long enough period of time for the child to drown. The case was closed as not verified for neglect, and the narrative in the investigation said that there were others at that pool that day who also were not supervising their children, and therefore her behavior was not any worse than anyone there that day. And that basically, you know, the analogy is, if I do not strap my child into a seatbelt in the car because my neighbors don't and my child dies, then that's acceptable behavior. And I don't think anyone in the field of public health would agree with that.
You know, the thing that's most distressing about this is the idea that while we all know, everybody gives lip service to the idea that sweeping changes are needed and we need to do something, it seems like a lot of energy has gone in, at least in the past, to actually massaging the numbers, trying to make sure that the public is, you can deal with the problem that way, not actually doing substantive changes. And I mean, do you have a sense, Carol, that the department's changing?
Well, I don't know. I am a reporter, and I therefore have an open mind. I will say this. One of the things that we reported in this series was that around 2010, the then Secretary of DCF had a long conversation via email with an agency insider who was very critical of some of these policies. And that secretary's reaction was, look, we have a ton of deaths that result from drowning and unsafe sleep situations. And by the way, most of those involve parents who are absolutely impaired on drugs or alcohol, particularly large doses of painkillers. And the secretary wrote an email that we put in our story that said, what would happen to our numbers if those go away? It's very hard to look at that conversation and not view it as deliberate.
Carol, can I just ask you one thing? I mean, coming into this from afar and listening to you describe some of these deaths and some of your investigation, I mean, there seem to be a couple of things going on. It's your investigation is holding public officials to account and making them answer questions about the definitions and so forth. But are you getting the sense that this conversation might be helping parents sort of understand, you know, what might harm a child? I mean, you'd like to think that parents all love their children and take care of them, but that maybe parents will hear this and maybe not turn their backs when their child is swimming, because they know that there are some legal definitions that could get them into, you know, deep trouble if they don't take care of their kid.
Unfortunately, I am not sanguine about that happening for a number of reasons. Most hospitals now educate parents at childbirth regarding the dangers of co-sleeping, just as they educate parents on the dangers of shaking an infant. I have not met a parent who has recently given birth who has said, "I simply didn't know that it was dangerous to drink to excess or pop two or three oxys and put my baby next to me in bed." They know. Number two, many of the parents who you see in these reports were told by DCF because they have histories with the department. And when the department comes to these homes, they educate them again. Sometimes they buy them cribs and pack and plays. And you see cases where the pack and play is in the room and there are toys and there is junk in those devices. And the parents do it anyway because it's easier for them and because they're stubborn. I'm unfortunately not at all optimistic that this is going to change soon.
Carol Marbin-Miller with the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson, Greg Allen, and David Green with NPR, all with us here on the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Carol, I want to ask you about two instances that Mike Carroll, the interim secretary of the Department of Children and Families, described to us in regards to this change in definition of what can be a verified death by neglect and abuse for the Department of Children and Families. One of those that he related to in regards to drowning, he suggested and in fact mentioned that, you know, drowning is tragic in all instances, and 3/4 of children who drown in Florida don't have any contact at all with the Department of Children and Families. And I think the intent of him talking about that to us was mentioning how difficult it is to describe those deaths as neglect deaths, for instance.
Well, I think it's certainly true that children die in Florida every day where their families had no contact with child welfare administrators, and those are tragic. But this is an agency that gets $1 billion a year, more than a billion, I forget the exact number. And I think that Floridians have a right to to believe, they ought to expect that when child welfare workers come in contact with the family, the children under that family's care will be better off. And what we discovered during the course of this series was that Florida policy had changed dramatically, tilting toward the rights of parents and away from the welfare and safety of children. And I think what we're now hearing is that lawmakers and citizens and advocates want that to tilt back in the direction of child safety. If a child protective investigator comes to your home on behalf of your child, that child will be left more safe than before.
And I want to ask you about the reform law that Governor Scott signed into law this week regarding the Department of Children and Families. The other instance that the interim secretary talked about, you referred to earlier as well, with parents under the influence of drugs and alcohol and co-sleeping with an infant, or passing out essentially with an infant and then smothering them accidentally. His assessment seemed to be pretty clear on that, but in fact, your investigation found those deaths may not be verified neglect deaths in some cases.
In many cases, they're not. We reviewed...
Which is astounding to think that a parent who is under chemical influence and kills a child...
Right, if there's a traffic accident, you know, it was drunk driving, it would be a felony.
That's right, yeah.
Well, there are a lot of elements at play here, and one of them is that until now, and we hope this will change, Florida had been singularly unaggressive with regard to parents who had drug and alcohol problems. If a child protective investigator came to your home and you were a drug addict, you had the absolute right to refuse a drug test, you had the absolute right to refuse drug treatment, and the agency would pursue the matter no further. That left particularly infants and toddlers in grave danger. Our sample of the 477 cases showed that about two-thirds of those deaths were among families with a severe drug or alcohol problem. And if a child dies and an investigator goes to the home, and if you refuse to be tested and you deny that you are a drug addict, they often will leave it at that.
The overhaul legislation that the Florida legislature passed this year and Governor Scott signed into law this week under the headline of the Miami Herald, Sweeping Child Welfare Changes. One of the critiques of that was that there wasn't enough resources, financial and otherwise, directed at community-based organizations to go after just the kinds of clients, the kinds of parents that are drug dependent or have alcohol problems that are at the core and at the heart and at the majority of the deaths that you identified.
Well, this is true. There was strong lobbying on behalf of the so-called community-based care agencies, the private foster care entities, that they be given a large infusion of cash for such things as caseworkers who oversee these troubled families, drug treatment, parenting classes, other services. And there was significant pushback both from DCF, which wanted that money in their budget, from lawmakers, from the governor's office. There was very little enthusiasm for providing a large influx of dollars to those programs. And I have to say that appeared to many to be short-sighted, in that we had $1 billion reserve of cash this year that was unanticipated.
Without those kinds of financial resources going toward those organizations, what are the sweeping overhauls included in this legislation?
Well, I don't want to suggest that this is not a good bill. I think it's a terrific bill.
You do?
Yes,
yeah.
for a number of reasons. One of them being what it says, even more than what it does, and that is, for the first time in a decade, Florida law says that the right of a child to live and be safe trumps the right of a parent to custody over him or her. That's tremendous. We've never done that.
That is a sea change in policy, certainly. Let's go to the phones here. Siobhan joining the Florida Roundup from Hollywood. Welcome to the program, Siobhan.
Thank you. Over the years, we've seen countless numbers of just instances of horrible tragedies. And it just seems that we don't want to admit that we don't care about poor children. And no matter what we do, it continues every couple of years. We throw some money, and despite what you say about a sea change with the new focus, I'm not sure that that's true. And I'm wondering if you might just actually discuss that these are usually, almost, I would say, exclusively poor children, and that we really are just sort of trying to make ourselves feel better about whatever we do.
Siobhan,
thank you for your time.
Siobhan, thank you for spurring on that kind of conversation. Carol, you dived into those 477 tragedies. Your thoughts on the economic disparities that you found?
There's no question that the population of children who come in contact with child protective services is overwhelmingly poor. That said, I do not agree with the position that child protective efforts target the poor and are disproportionate and harmful toward the poor. Poverty should not be conflated with neglect, mm-hmm. and poverty should never be used as an excuse for abuse or neglect. And I think that where we have resources to make parents better parents, we should use them. And I think that if a parent is amenable to instruction and parenting classes and drug treatment, I'm all for it. What I am not for is taking an infant who has a cracked skull because his mother used him as a punching bag and giving that infant right back to the mother with no services or intervention in that home. And we were doing that with some regularity.
And that has changed with the new law that Governor Scott signed into law this week. We will see how that is implemented, obviously, in the days and weeks ahead. Carol Marvin Miller keeping up the work with Innocence Lost at the Miami Herald. David Green and Greg Allen with NPR along with me. I'm Tom Hudson. The Florida Roundup continues with the cost to taxpayers of the rush to open charter schools only to have them close down.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm NPR's Greg Allen.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
It's summer vacation for most students, but in some cases, schools are out for in forever. Charter schools have been closing at an increasing rate in South Florida, especially in Broward and Palm Beach counties. The Sun Sentinel newspaper looked into how and why more than 50 charter schools in the past 5 years have closed in South Florida, some lasting less than a year.
The parents really didn't know what was going on, not until they went that Monday morning and there was a note on the school that it had closed and they had to find an alternative place to put their child.
That was Crystal Castellano, a former charter school teacher, talking about the next generation charter school. It closed only weeks after opening. Here with me is Sun Sentinel investigative reporter Amy Shipley, transplanted state impact reporter John O'Connor, who's moved from Tampa and is now based in Miami, and NPR Morning Edition host David Green. Amy, why don't you tell us about your series and what you found with these charter schools?
I will. Thank you very much. And first, I want to say I wish my co-writer, Karen Yee, could be here to join us. She would have some great insights to offer, but she's off on vacation, so I'm very jealous about that.
Good for her.
We've seen a rise, particularly in Palm Beach and Broward counties, in schools that open and very quickly close. Some last a year, some last a few months, some last only a few weeks. And these are charter schools, which are public schools, but they are funded by public money, obviously. They can be opened by individuals or cities or corporations. And they're very, very, very popular in Florida, and they're very easy to open in Florida. So we've seen, with this enormous growth in the charter school industry, we've seen this corresponding problem of these very quick closures. And obviously, when you have a school that only lasts a few weeks or a few months, you're going to have students who they probably don't receive much education in that short period of time. These schools are obviously financially troubled. And then they are forced to find new schools, you know, in the middle of the year. And so it's disruptive for them. We saw a lot of waste in taxpayer dollars. That's the other issue. And so that's what we looked at very closely.
Is the problem that we're allowing schools to open that don't have the financial resources, or the schools are being improperly managed? I mean, what's the sense here? I mean, why are we allowing the schools to open in the first place? I guess.
Yeah, it's a lot of different things that are contributing to this. I mean, for one thing, it's very, very easy to open a public school in South Florida, in Florida in general. The application to get a public school is very long and complex, but it focuses almost entirely on issues related to how you will operate the school itself. And if you've done one, you can do 10. They're available online, so you can review an application and put yours together and sound like you know what you're talking about. And that is the basis on which you are given the right to open a school, and then the public money that goes with that.
My analogy to this is public schools are kind of like the old Coke, classic Coke. Everybody knows what they get. You either like it or you don't like it. The new Coke in this, John O'Connor, the charter schools. New Coke died because the market didn't like it. Nobody was buying it. So is the market demanding these charter schools, or is the education industry foisting upon the market?
It is a combination of both. I think it's fair to say that there are a lot of parents who really like the idea of charter schools. They like a lot of parents think charter schools are safer. A lot of parents like the fact that charter schools can specialize in, you know, marine biology or some kind of subject like that. It is also a fact that there are state policies in Florida that facilitate the growth of charter schools and allow charter schools to grow quickly. Particularly, I mean, in the last couple of years, we have what is called a high-performing charter school. So if you own a charter school and run one in one part of the state and it earns a good grade on the state's report card, it then becomes easier to open a charter school with the same model in another part of the state. And so the state of Florida has made it easier for charter schools to expand.
Simple question, Amy. Why does the charter school close?
Why do they close?
Yeah.
Well, we saw some cases in which the schools didn't even have classrooms. You know, they were bussing students to
field trips. There was no actual school.
There was no actual classroom, no facility. We saw some other cases where the people running the schools were not able to provide buses for the students. They were not able to provide textbooks. The schools were deeply in debt. You know, they were unable to pay the bills. So it becomes, it's a business that is not functioning, and that's why they have to close.
What I'm wondering, John and Amy, what's the role of the school boards here? Because, I mean, we know that they're not very happy about what goes on with a lot of charter schools, and I know that they've been involved, at least here in Miami-Dade, in seeing some close eventually. But how much oversight do they have over these?
I'll start. I mean, it's been kind of a gradual process over several years, in that school boards are limited in what kind of say they have over the charter schools. And so in the past, Broward County in particular, Palm Beach County, in Central Florida as well, school boards have said no to applications. Then they get appealed. And, you know, up the food chain, there's two other places where charter schools can come back and win approval, the Charter School Board of Appeals and then the State Board of Education. And in a lot of cases, those school board decisions have been overturned. And so you'll see school boards now who say, look, we would have challenged this in the past, but we've lost before. We're not going to challenge it now. You've also seen school boards where the attorneys come to the board and the board will raise legitimate questions about this school has unrealistic growth and enrollment figures. This school has inappropriate curriculum. It's not tied to our standards. But the attorneys for the school board will say, you cannot reject this application on that basis. And so the school board will back off and allow the application to go through.
Yeah, I'll second that. It's very difficult for the school districts to do much of anything. I mean, they are limited in being able to deny applications. And then they're further limited in being able to monitor and really follow the taxpayer dollar once the school is opened, because the charter schools do not fall under the jurisdiction of the school board like public schools do. They're public schools, but they are governed by their own independent boards of directors. So now the taxpayer dollar is going to those boards of directors, and you are relying on those boards, which are often filled with, you know, lovely people from the neighborhood whose qualifications we really, you know, can vary. Some are terrific. And by the way, there are some terrific charter schools in South Florida. I mean, that goes without saying. But you have now these individual governing boards that are following the money, and the competence may or may not be there, number one. Number two, many of them hire out for-profit companies to do most of the work of running the schools. Now we completely lose sight of this taxpayer dollar. We have no idea what is happening. And there are some terrific management companies, I have no doubt, in Florida and elsewhere. We really don't know that because they don't open their books. So, and we've certainly seen cases where we're kind of wondering what happened to the money.
Amy, John, can you put in perspective sort of the numbers here? I mean, I could imagine an argument that it's sort of like, okay, if you're experimenting with new kinds of schools, you know, you're taking a risk and there will be some failure that you have to accept. I mean, are these isolated failures and there's a significant success rate outside? Or are we seeing a general trend here where charter schools start up and just, you know, collapse? Don't
yeah,
worry.
No, I wouldn't go quite that far, but I think the numbers are significant enough that it's becoming disconcerting. You know, there's huge growth in this industry. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing the closures, too, is that the growth is so high that we no longer have these sort of innovative, cool schools that are serving a niche, you know, in a community that can really thrive and flourish. We now have so many, they're stepping on each other's toes. They open in the same buildings in some cases. There are charter schools that are operating in the very same building. So they're competing with each other. It's the numbers are rising in a way that is clearly disconcerting.
I'd have to double check, but I think it's roughly in the range of 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 approved charter schools has closed.
Not isolated.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a significant percent then. But what about the quality of the education? I mean, ultimately, the product is what the market wants here. Parents are asking for these charter schools because they're unhappy with their neighborhood public schools, safety concerns, curriculum, all those kinds of things, Amy, that you mentioned. What about the quality of the education? What do we know?
Well, some of them are terrific. You know, there are some terrific charter schools that are getting A grades and parents love them and they're doing very, very well. And there are plenty of those in South Florida. Others have very low grades. They're not succeeding in providing this better alternative to our public schools.
But is it any different to say, for instance, from the variety of responses that we get from public schools as well? Some are great schools and some are failing.
Well, I think one thing I would say is it's difficult to say in some cases because we don't even have grades for all of these charter schools. For whatever reason, they don't test enough students. The ability to evaluate both by following the money and following the grades is challenging.
In general, if you're a charter school student, you're more likely to be in an A-rated school. You're also more likely to be in an F-rated school. So there is a disparity in the quality between the top performing schools and the bottom performing schools. A national study of charter school performance found that it's basically a coin flip between performance, you know, whether charter schools do better than traditional public schools or not.
Quite a bet with education. John O'Connor covering education for us here at WLR. And Amy Shipley, thank you so much for sharing your investigation with us with the Sun Sentinel. Greg Allen with National Public Radio. Always great to have you, Greg. And David Green, welcome to Miami from NPR.
Thank you.
Visiting
for
here in South
me.
Florida after a week in Cuba. That is the Florida Roundup this week. The program back on the air 6 a.m. tomorrow. It is produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. The South Florida Arts Beat is next, how an old Miami music pub is getting its own documentary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.